I'm from the Institute of Technology, but technology is not my forte. So, thank you for being able to do that. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. And what we're going to talk about is earthquakes, what they are, why we have them, what's going to happen when we have a 7.8 earthquake, and how you need to be prepared for that. Also, what I'm going to share with you today is some of the technology of what we do with the earthquake information, how we monitor earthquakes at Caltech, and then what we do with that information to create earthquake tools for our emergency responders and for yourselves to be able to access information about what happened to that earthquake so that you know what to do after that earthquake has happened. So knowing where it was, how big it is, how big of an area it affected, how it affected you so that you know then how to respond after that earthquake as well. And that is our earthquake tools that we do with the data that we collect from our earthquake monitoring system. So, how many people have seen the San Andreas movie? All right. One person. It is fantastical. It is not documentary, so don't go for the science. But it does have some really, really good messages for earthquake preparedness. So they did a really good job on that, with that. So anyway, if you have any questions, go ahead and feel free to ask me with those questions, and we'll try to have a question and answer period afterwards. So, yeah, actually that works for me too, because then I can see it too. Well, what it was when, back in the early days, okay, earthquakes started, Caltech started monitoring earthquakes in the 1920s. Actually was not a result. It actually, the first monitoring stations were owned by Carnegie Institute and not by Caltech. And so as a result of the 1906 earthquake, scientists came down and studied, wanted to see that what happened on the San Andreas Fault. So they wanted to then study the San Andreas Fault, see where it goes. And so they traced the San Andreas Fault all the way down to Southern California. So the scientists stayed down here, started the seismic network down here to monitor earthquakes down here because they knew this was a highly seismic area as well as Northern California. In those days, scientists had to develop their own apparatuses. So they needed a way of measuring one earthquake against the other. So how big was this earthquake? How big was this earthquake? The Richter scale is a mathematical equation. It is not an instrument. It's a mathematical equation that measures the energy that's released from that earthquake. So when you have an earthquake starts, the further it travels, the more energy it creates. The further it travels, the larger the magnitude. Magnitude is the measurement of the energy that is created from that rupture. And so the Richter scale is that takes the released times the distance that it travels. And so magnitude is the measurement of that energy. And that is what scientists use to measure one earthquake against the other. However, what you really care about is the intensity of shaking. How much are you going to shake? That is not necessarily dependent on the, it is dependent on the magnitude, but the further away you are from that epicenter, the shaking is not going to be the same as somebody closer. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, where did the Richter scale get its name? It was not named by Caltech. It was not named by Richter. Richter was one of the scientists at Caltech at the time that they came up with the Richter scale of measuring the energy from that earthquake. But it was Dr. Gutenberg, it was Dr. Benioff, it was Dr. Wood, it was Dr. Richter. All those other people, scientists, came from Germany. They had very heavy German accents. So when the media would come to Caltech to interview scientists about earthquakes, they would also always ask for Dr. because they could understand what he was saying. So it was actually the media that gave the name Richter scale to that mathematical equation of measuring those earthquakes, and they were actually the ones that named it. At the dismay of Dr. Gutenberg's wife, who never forgave them for that, because he didn't get the credit. Okay, that is picked up by the sensors. So our ground motion sensors that are buried in the ground, they will pick up and they will determine that movement. We also have vertical seismometers as well as horizontal seismometers, and they will measure either the vertical or the horizontal. All that information goes back to our computers at Caltech. It puts it all together and then comes up with the data. Yeah, some of this will probably might be answered, although that one wouldn't be. Yeah. No, actually, we saw it in 1D at Warner Brothers. They gave us a screening of it. Then Lucy and my boss, Al, went into the red carpet. They saw it in 3D, which they didn't like because they said you could tell that the cars weren't real. You could tell the buildings weren't real, so they didn't really like the 3D. Yeah. Well, let's start the presentation, and that will be answered. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, it might be different. One last question. No. There are some things that are real about it and other things that aren't. You have to understand that certain things, first of all, we're not going to, the fault, San Andreas fault cannot pull apart. If you, part of the dynamics of a rupture is that that fault is rupturing. If you pull it apart, you stop the rupture. Okay? So, fault pulls apart like it did in the San Andreas, it stops the rupture. That, and we're not capable of a 9.0. There are some things that are realistic. Also, not all the buildings are going to fall down. We're looking at, when we did our 7.8 earthquake scenario, which I will show you in a minute, we're looking at one out of every 16 buildings falling down, not every building falling down. So there, it is fantastical, as the producer puts it. It is not a documentary. There are some things that are very good about the preparedness in it, and it also is not a movie about the science. It is a movie that keeps you on the edge of your seat about the action. So it's all an action movie with that. The only people that were really upset was the LA County Fire Department because The Rock steals the helicopter and goes to San Francisco with it. And so firemen take care of what they need to do and not their families first. So that was the one message that they didn't care about, but they figured people would see it as a movie, so it's okay. So with earthquakes, we have thousands of earthquakes a day throughout the world. And so most of those earthquakes are going to occur along our plate tectonics, our boundaries. So where those plates come together, our boundaries, and most of the earthquakes will, it's not me, it's this cutting out. most of our earthquakes occur will be along those plate boundaries. So you can see here actually that most of those earthquakes, this is about a 20-year vision of those earthquakes, and you can see most of them occur along our plate boundaries. So you can see with Nepal, this is the Nepal earthquake. What happened with the Nepal earthquake? Nepal sits on a plate boundary. And so what happened with that is that one plate went underneath the other plate and lifted up. When it lifted up, it created that earthquake. An earthquake is what? It is the movement of rocks created by stress that's put on it. So with the Nepal earthquake, the one plate lifted up, the Indian plate went underneath the Eurasia plate, lifting up that Eurasia plate. Now this has been going on for millions of years, which is why we have the Himalayan mountains. The rocks at the top of the Himalayan mountains 150 million years ago were once at the bottom of the ocean. And because that plate lifting upward, it creates those mountains. Where you have mountains, you're most likely going to have seismic activity that then created those mountains. So it is not unusual for Nepal to have an earthquake of this size. So it's all about the buildings. Earthquakes have never killed anybody. How many people believe that? Nobody believes that? It's not the earthquake. It is the buildings that fall down. It's the infrastructure we've put there. It's people that panic because they don't know what to do. So if the earth was a shake right now, what would you do? Okay, got it right. Under the table. You are going to drop to the ground before the energy throws you off your feet. You're going to crawl and get underneath something that will protect you from falling objects. You're going to hang onto that table because the energy in this room will move that table and throw it somewhere else. So you want to hang onto that table. You do not get into a doorway. If in 1857 was our largest earthquake, that the last time we had a magnitude 7.8 in Southern California was in 1857, but there were only 4,000 people living in the Los Angeles basin at that time. There were no tall buildings, there were adobe houses. The adobe houses fell down, what was still standing? The door frame. So people got the idea, go into the door frame, strongest part of the building. Unless you live in an adobe house, do not go into that door frame. On that door now is what? Or the door frame now is what? Doors. Those doors sometimes weigh up to 150 to 200 pounds. Even if they're locked, this building will twist and turn, the doors will open, they'll slam open and shut. You're standing in that doorway, what's going to happen to you? Glass is going to be flying and hitting you. Anything in this room will be flying and hitting you, and you probably won't be able to stand up anyway. So you want to get down on the ground. How many people have experienced the Northridge earthquake? Okay. How many people were able to move in the Northridge earthquake? Some of you probably, because you were further away, didn't have the directionality, so some would. Many people could not even put a step in front of themselves because that energy in that room then kept them into place. You want to drop to the ground the minute you feel shaking. If you cannot do that, what you're going to do is you're going to set your parking brake on your chair and hopefully grab a pillow or something you can put over your head to protect you from the falling objects. Sometimes you get under there, but you can't get back up. And so that's a problem, too. Have a place in your house where it might be a couch, it might be a chair that you can sit into, and then you can put that pillow up over your head if you can't get down on the ground to be able to do that. But that's how you want to protect yourself. Okay. And that's one thing you don't want to do is run. People tend to run. Well, with an earthquake, it's shaking everywhere. Where are you running? Long Beach was a magnitude 6.4 earthquake. It was the beginning of mitigation in Los Angeles or Southern California because it was the first earthquake since the 1857, the first earthquake that we had had with damage. At that time, the tallest building in Los Angeles was
City Hall.
Now it's the smallest building, okay? But it was the tallest, and it moved several centimeters to the north with that movement. When they put the isolators underneath a few years ago, we went underneath, and there was little damage from that earthquake from that. But it wasn't a very tall building. But look at what we have today. So you do not want to run. How many people participate in the Great California Shakeout in October? Good for you. It's an opportunity, if not any other time in the year, which you should probably do it once a month, but at least it's Shakeout, an opportunity for everybody to practice drop, cover, hold on. You may say, yeah, I know I'm going to get underneath that table. But if you don't practice it and this room starts to shake, I will guarantee you that 99% of you will not think about getting underneath that table. So what you want to do is teach your body what to do. So when the shaking starts, your body automatically responds. It's called body memory, and it responds even though your mind goes blank. So you need to practice with your body to be practicing that drop, cover, hold on. Then you're SOL. But here's the deal. When I walked into this room, I right away spotted where I'm going, okay? I know I'm getting under that table. So hopefully, before the rest of you think about it, that table's already full because we're not all getting underneath that table. So then the rest of you have to figure out what to do. And what are you going to do? The least amount of movement you make, the least opportunity to get hurt. You do not want to start running. At the end of this presentation, I will do a demonstration on earthquake early warning, which is what we've been working on at Caltech with UC Berkeley. It will be run by USGS, and it will give you a few seconds of warning before those damaging waves hit your location. But even then, you still got to know how to respond to that and what you're going to do and where you're going to go. So if you have 50 seconds of warning, you don't want to start looking for the perfect place to go. Drop immediately and protect yourself. Put your head underneath your chair. Hang on to that chair because you want to protect your head and your neck. Those are the two places you want to check. If these chairs weren't here, then what you want to get to is an interior wall. That's an exterior wall. That's most likely an exterior wall. This part might be interior. That corner would be the best place to go. Or here, what you want to do is get to an interior wall. In an earthquake, the building twists and turns because of the horizontal and vertical waves that go through it. The roof goes up, the walls fall out. So you want to be to an interior wall or to a place that's going to protect you from that. Okay? So with Nepal, buildings fell down because they don't build them properly. So it's all about how you build that infrastructure that's not going to fall down and damage you with that. I need to get closer. So earthquakes pose a serious risk to our nation. We actually have about $4.1 billion in damages nationwide from earthquakes. You don't realize that. The Baja earthquake that happened a few years ago that was down in Mexico on Easter Sunday, and we kind of felt the shaking, did $100 million in damage to our Imperial Valley. People don't realize that. And so we have 77% of the risk of that here in California, of that $4.1 billion of damages are here in California. So we are at most risk. The Napa earthquake, they're still trying to figure out the cost. It's anywhere from $400 million to $1 billion in damages. They're still figuring out the economic cost of that because businesses are still trying to get into their buildings. 1,000 buildings fell out their foundation. It is imperative that you make sure that your homes and your businesses are retrofitted. So if you're on a slab, you want to be bolted to the foundation. If you have a crawl space underneath, you want to make sure you reinforce your cripple wall. Otherwise, when your house twists and turns, it will fall into that cripple wall and you'll have major damage to that house. So you want to make sure that you retrofit your houses. There is a program right now called Brace and Bolt from California Earthquake Authority. They go in and they pick certain zip codes to apply for a $3,000 grant to allow you to retrofit your houses. So watch the newspapers, check with your city, find when LA might have that again. They just finished one, and LA has several zip codes in LA were covered underneath that. So in California, we're a multi-hazard state. We're not just earthquakes, we're fires, we're floods, we're tsunamis, we're windstorms, as we saw in Pasadena a few years ago. We are landslides. When we have earthquakes, there's going to be secondary effects, and we're going to have fires. We're going to have floods from broken water mains. We're going to have electrified water from wires that fall into that water from the broken water mains. We're going to have landslides, and we're going to have tsunamis. So with that earthquake comes secondary effects. Now, we can change some of those secondary effects by being prepared, being vigilant, doing earthquake early warning that we can reduce some of those, mitigate some of those losses. So what is an earthquake? An earthquake is the movement of rocks created by the stress that's put on it. So inside the earth, it's hot. That heat propagates to the surface. On top of the surface, it's made up of tectonic plates. So it's like a puzzle, and the surface then fits together like puzzle pieces, and they're called plate tectonics. They go down to the core of the earth. It's that thick that these plates go down. The heat then propagates to the surface, moves those plates around. What sits on top of those are our continents. So billions of years ago, we were one mass of land. Because of that movement, our continents are where they are today. And they keep moving. Because of that, then, it builds up stress. So where these plates then push together, it builds up that stress. So it's like pushing your fingers together, and pretty soon something has to break because the stress builds up and the rocks move. And that's what creates an earthquake. Earthquake is merely the movement of rocks, whether it is tectonically with our plates or it's man-made, and that's called fracking. So when they do it man-made and push water into, the rocks move, creates that earthquake. So it is the movement of rocks. So here in the United States, most of our earthquakes occur in Alaska. Secondary to that is California. So we are second to the number of earthquakes, but we are first at risk. Why? Because of population. Population and buildings. In Alaska, they don't have a lot of 20-story, 50-story buildings. We do. They don't have 22 million people living in an area. We do. So we are first at risk in the United States for earthquakes. So what's happening and why are we first at risk and why do we have earthquakes? Because we sit on one of those plate boundaries. So we talked about where the plates come together as a plate boundary. So we sit on the Pacific plate, on the North American plate. Where those two plates come together is the San Andreas Fault. The San Andreas Fault is our plate boundary. So it is moving. The Pacific Plate is moving 2 inches a year to the north. In a few millions of years, Los Angeles will be adjacent to Oakland. We'll push San Francisco kind of out of the way, which is probably why they don't acknowledge us down here. And so we're going to push them out of the way. We are not going to become an island. That's a myth. The Gulf of California will get larger because of that movement. And so Arizona may be beachfront property one day. So you might want to have your relatives buy property there. In a few millions of years, they'll be on the Gulf of California. If you travel to San Francisco yearly, you get there a little faster every year because you're going that 2 inches less a year. We are also a strike-slip fault, meaning that one plate is grinding past the other plate. However, up north in Oregon, up in Washington, Alaska, around the plate over to Japan, Indonesia, Chile are all subduction zones, which mean one plate goes underneath the other plate, and when you have movement, it's moving two plates. When you do that, it creates a lot more energy, bigger magnitudes, because magnitude's the measurement of the energy. So they have magnitude nines. The largest earthquake ever occurred in modern times, since we've been keeping track, was in 1960, was a magnitude 9.5. That earthquake was in Chile, so that 8.8 they had a few years ago was relatively small for them. Chile builds their buildings so they don't fall down. In that 8.8 earthquake they had it in 2010, one building did split in half. However, nobody was killed in that building. And they only had about three buildings that were actually damaged. They had another one a little bit later, about 200 miles away. That did do more damage because it was a smaller village. It wasn't as prepared. But Chile does a good job in preparedness and building their buildings. They also don't have natural gas. Natural gas then creates fires. So they didn't have fires, although I understand from the consulate that they are now using natural gas, which probably isn't a good decision. Anyway, we have over 30 earthquakes a day in Southern California. It's not just the ones that you feel. So we have over 30 earthquakes a day. Most of those are ones and twos, or a 0.8, a 0.5. And that is created by the movement of the plate, the Pacific plate. So as it moves, it stretches. It pulls. And so it's constantly pulling and constantly moving those rocks. And so when we have a small event, we never know when it's going to become a bigger event. We cannot predict earthquakes. Earth prediction is an exact place, an exact time, an exact magnitude. We don't know that. We don't know the stress, how much stress that fault is going to take before it moves. It may rupture a small distance and be a magnitude 1. It may keep rupturing and be a magnitude 2, a 3, a 4, a 5, a 6, a 7, or an 8. The largest earthquake that they expect to have down here is a magnitude 8, 8.3. We're not looking at those 9s because we are a strike-slip fault. So it doesn't create enough energy to create that magnitude. However, there is something called earthquakes triggering other faults. So we can have an earthquake on a fault that triggers another fault, and then that has another earthquake as well. It also could be a fault that connects to another fault. So one fault ruptures, sends the energy into another fault, and then that fault ruptures, creating a larger event. But they still think that we will have. We never say never, because science is science. It's not a definite, but it isn't really capable of that. So we have over 30 earthquakes a day. These are some of our major earthquakes in the last 80 years. On average, we have a magnitude 6 earthquake about every 5 years. We've been in an earthquake drought for the last 25 years because of the Northridge earthquake. It did release some of the stress. So those 2s, the 3s, the 4s, the 5s do nothing to relieve stress. So all these years when we were little and our parents would say, we want these little earthquakes that relieve the stress, it doesn't. It needs to be a magnitude 6 or above to relieve, to have enough energy released to then release some of that stress. So these are some of our major earthquakes we've had over the last 80 years. 1933, of course, being the beginning of mitigation in Southern California, when we had damage to those buildings because it was the first earthquake we'd had when we have buildings here. So they started looking to what we can do to mitigate those losses. Fall down. Okay, so that's one thing we do at Caltech. We use the data that we learn about earthquakes, knowing about frequencies of earthquakes. Earthquakes have a frequency sound, so do buildings. We don't build our buildings within that frequency, so they're not compensated by those waves. And so we use the information that we gather every day off of earthquakes. So 1933 was the beginning of mitigation. 1994, of course, our last damaging earthquake, but not our last large earthquake. 1991, we had a magnitude 7.3 earthquake. Here's California, not tall buildings. It was populated. It also triggered an earthquake 3 hours later in Big Bear. 1999, we had a magnitude 7.1 earthquake. That was out in the high desert. was a military base. The only one there was the Jackrabbits, and so nobody really cared about that earthquake, nor did they. I think we felt it here. We did feel Landers in Pasadena. I don't know if you felt it here. We did in Pasadena. Did you feel that? And probably the 1991 also. But nobody paid attention to it because there was no damage. But if either one of those had been in a populated area, we would have had twice the damage in Northridge. So we've dodged the bullet in the last few years because those could have been in more populated areas. And, of course, we're moving outward more and more all the time. And so we're getting less of that remote area with those where those earthquakes can happen. Now, that doesn't mean earthquakes happen in remote areas. There is no pattern to earthquakes. There is no time of day that they happen. Earthquakes don't happen because we have a big one in Japan. It means we're going to have a big one here. There is no pattern to earthquakes. People like to set up patterns in their head. How many people have heard of earthquake weather? Okay. There is no such thing as earthquake weather. Earthquakes start very deep in the ground, and so they're not affected by weather at all. How many people think that their animals can predict earthquakes? Okay. What they're doing is they're feeling ones that you don't feel. Sometimes they're followed by an earthquake you do feel. So then you think that dog has predicted that earthquake. That dog is feeling something that either happened before earthquakes start, they stop. So it might feel a foreshock to one that you felt. And you remember that because you felt the one after it. But your dog may do that lots of times and feel those ones and twos that you don't pay any attention to because you don't feel one afterwards. Well, there's been studies on that. We have studied magnetism, we have studied electricity, we've studied gravity pull, we've studied animals. There's been no correlation that they have found anything yet. Not to mean they won't later, but they haven't found any correlation to that yet. So people like to set up patterns in their head because with earthquakes we have no warning. And so people like to be in control, so they like to set up patterns that they think they know when that earthquake is going to come. But so far that has not been, they're not proven. So we have over 300 known faults in Southern California. It is not just the San Andreas Fault. So out of those 300 known faults, some people will say, well, how many unknown faults are there? We don't know. Okay, there's still a lot of faults out there. We go and we trace the large ones. Why? Because those are going to be the damaging earthquakes. So the earthquakes that are deep in the ground are going to be, and long, are going to be the damaging earthquakes. Those are the ones that we want to know about. There's hundreds of them that are surface, right below the surface, that are small. And so they're not going to do any damage, and of course it costs a lot of money to do this, and so we don't know about those. These are also the ones that are affected by induced seismology. So fracking or something like that will affect those, but they're not going to create large earthquakes. No, they do create earthquakes, but they don't create damaging big earthquakes. And we don't really have too much of that here. We have geothermal, where they're doing geothermal out by Salton Sea. But like I said, it will affect the smaller faults that are closer to the surface, not the big ones that are down deep, 20 miles deep in the ground. Those are the ones that create the large earthquakes. So what you're seeing in Oklahoma is from fracking. That is induced seismology from that. And so they're having those magnitude 4s and the magnitude 3s and the magnitude 5s in there. So, but we don't have a lot of that here. So, No. Northridge was an unknown fault we didn't know about till we had that earthquake, and it was created by that weakness. So we didn't know it existed. From that, it was a blind thrust fault, meaning that the fault thrusted upward but did not break the surface. Most earthquakes will break the surface because you have movement. So it moves deep in the ground, but it also moves at the surface. That one did not move at the surface, so it was a blind thrust. So we had to rely on our data to find out where that fault was, rather than go out and look at where the earth moved. And so it has that, but it was not, did not trigger another earthquake, nor was it connected to another fault. Actually, it's quite a ways away from the Newport-Inglewood. So here we have some of our major faults. So San Andreas Fault is 850 miles long. Goes from the Salton Sea up through San Francisco, goes out into the ocean where it's recycling itself into the core of the earth. It doesn't just stop at the Salton Sea because that plate actually goes all the way down into Mexico and down into South America, but the dynamics change at the Salton Sea and it starts going different ways. So when it has ruptures, it doesn't rupture 250 miles, it will rupture that one segment of that fault. So it's a different dynamic down below. So along with the San Andreas, we also have the San Jacinto, which is a big risk, the Elsinore Fault. They will then lead into the Rancho Cucamonga, the Sierra Madre, the Ventura. We have the Hollywood. We have the Newport Inglewood. We have the Rose Canyon. We have the Palos Verdes. We have the Pointe Hills. We have the Whittier. We have the Wilshire. We have the Rose Canyon. And so all of these are major earthquake faults that can create a magnitude 6.7 or above. So we have 24 that are underneath Los Angeles Basin with that risk of earthquakes. Is liquefaction. And it's in the marina? Yeah, there's a fault there. Yeah, that's part of the Newport Inglewood Fault. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and with that, they're rupturing, and it might be a fault zone. Not every earthquake happens on the fault. It might be a fault zone. Actually, I'll get to that in a minute. So, we have over 300 known earthquake faults in Southern California. So this is not to scare, it is to make people aware of what they need to be prepared for. So looking at this map, you can see some of these faults, how close they are together, how they crisscross each other. Also, here where those red dots are, that is that La Habra earthquake that we had last year. So you can see the main shock as well as the aftershocks from that event. This was not on a fault, this was in a fault zone. So where you have faults crossing, sometimes those earthquakes are in a fault zone and not necessarily right on the fault. They're not always on the fault. And that's one of the things we will be doing at Caltech. So when you turn on your television to see what happened, the media that comes to Caltech, we have a media center there. They come there, and one of the things we will be looking at, so we can give you magnitude, location, and depth of that earthquake right away within milliseconds of that event. We can give you that information. But then we need to pour over the data to find out what fault it was on, where it was located, what was the direction of the energy, which makes a difference on what you're going to feel. And so all of that may take about 45 minutes to an hour for us to pour over the information. So how do we name a fault? A fault is usually named, or an earthquake is named by the fault it's on. If it's not on a fault, then it will be a fault zone. So the La Habra earthquake was close to La Habra, and so it was named for that, but it was actually in a Whittier fault zone. Became an issue with the Northridge earthquake, because it also makes a difference. If you have a lot of damage, you want to be called the Northridge earthquake, because who's going to get the money from FEMA? Northridge, right? So it was right next door to Reseda. And so we were actually getting calls from the city because they hadn't, because 25 years ago we didn't have the technology today. It took a little bit longer to determine where that actually was. And so they were fighting, they were anxiously waiting to make sure it was Reseda or Northridge because it made a difference in their FEMA funding according to them. But it was Northridge, it was not Reseda. Oh gosh, I don't know. I must have missed that one. Did I sleep through that one? Could be. Oh, there was a con. Was that a 4.1? Or the 3.9? Was that the one for the weekend? Mm-hmm. Was that what it was? Yeah. Yeah. You know, we've been having a lot more fours recently because now we're getting back to normal. This is what normal should be. A pattern, there is no pattern, it gets normal, we have a big one, that doesn't happen. We don't know. It could be another 10 years before we have a major earthquake. Or it could be tomorrow. We don't know. So we live in a very highly seismic zone. And so that's important for you to know because that makes a difference on us doing early warning. It's complicated and difficult for us to do early warning because we're not just monitoring one fault. We're monitoring a lot of faults. And we can be having more than one earthquake at a time. On those faults. So what happens when we have an earthquake? An earthquake starts deep in the ground, and so it is called the hypocenter. It is an area. Rocks move, energy is created, that energy travels out and propagates in a circle. It's like dropping a pebble in a pond, and it creates waves. It's the same with an earthquake. You have that rupture, and the waves propagate out in the surface. And then those waves propagate to the surface of the earth and break through the surface, and that's called the epicenter. It is not an exact point, so it's not going to be your house. It's an area that that happens in. So it starts at the hypocenter. Waves travel upward to surface of the earth, and then those waves travel across the surface of the earth. And that's what you're feeling, are those seismic waves. So we have a P wave, we have an S wave. P wave is a preliminary wave, S wave is a surface wave. The P wave travels at 3.5 miles per second. The S wave then follows after that at 2 miles per second. The P wave has shaking, but not damaging shaking. It is then followed by the S wave, the surface wave that does have the damaging shaking. It will have your vertical, your horizontal shaking, your Rayleigh waves, and your Love waves. So you will have up and down motion, you will have sideways motion, and it's like a compression. So those waves will go forward and bounce back, forward and bounce back. So when we have an earthquake, and it's a large one, you may hear it. It sounds like a train coming. You might experience the Northridge earthquake or with the Whittier earthquake in 1987, and you will hear it coming. It sounds like a train. It's actually the ground moving is what you're hearing. So you will feel that shaking, and then it'll get stronger, 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 stronger because your S wave is coming through. And that's what does your damage, is that S wave. So when you feel that shaking, you want to drop down to the ground, crawl and get underneath something until that shaking is done with. If it's a smaller event and you're closer to the epicenter, then those waves are going to be closer together. So you will feel that boom, boom, or the shake. Depending on where you are and how those waves travel through where you are is how you're going to feel it and how you're going to experience it. And everybody, people will feel it in different ways. The travel times? The P wave is your preliminary. And S wave is your secondary or surface wave. And surface wave has the damage in it. So with... Well, that's probably true because the first wave is going to push and then it comes back. Then it pushes and then it comes back. It's compressional. But it's and probably back then they didn't know as much as they know today. So,
What then is an aftershock?
Okay, so first, if you have an earthquake, every earthquake is individual. Earthquake starts, it stops. Each earthquake has a different dynamics, which we're going to talk about in a minute. So, first you have an earthquake, let's say you have a magnitude 5.4. It is then followed, maybe minutes, hours, or a day or so, and you have in the same area, you have a magnitude 6.7. Then that 5.4 became your foreshock. The larger one becomes your main shock. Smaller ones become your aftershocks. But they're all individual earthquakes. Not all earthquakes are followed by a foreshock. Most earthquakes, if they're large enough, are followed by aftershocks. Smaller events will not be usually followed by aftershocks because they didn't create enough movement of the earth. An aftershock is the earth trying to find its equilibrium as to where to go. And so small events won't trigger aftershocks. So, again, magnitude represents the amount of energy released from that rupture, and scientists use that to measure one earthquake against the other. But what you care about is how much are you going to shake. So if we say it's a magnitude 7.8 earthquake, doesn't mean you're going to feel a 7.8 earthquake where you are. If you're 100 miles away, as those waves travel, they lose some of their energy. However, there's other dynamics to that as well. So, with shaking, and that's what you care about, what makes the difference in what you feel and the damage that's done is, first of all, what is the magnitude? How much energy was released originally? How much energy is traveling across the surface? The distance you are from the fault will make a difference. How far away you are. Now, the San Andreas might start to rupture 150 miles away, but where is it when it gets up here? It's only 30 miles away. It's just on the other side of the San Gabriel Mountains. So if it ruptures 180 miles to the north, it's only going to be about 30 miles away. Well, from Pasadena here, it's a little further. So you're about 50 miles away from it here. So the directionality of the energy. When you have a rupture, it will rupture, and as it ruptures, the heavy energy is going to be pushed in the direction that it's rupturing. So like with the Nepal earthquake, when you look at the data from that, there was very little shaking and damage at the hypocenter of that earthquake. All the damage is to the north, where it ruptured to, because that's where the heavy energy was being sent. And that will make a difference in what you feel in an earthquake. How many people have experience an earthquake, you call somebody across the street and say, wow, did you feel that? And they said, I didn't feel a thing. Because the energy was traveling in your direction. Chimneys are down on one side of the street, not down on the other side of the street. Not because they had a better contractor, but because possibly the soils might be a little bit different, but probably most likely it was the direction of that energy went right through that area more. Soils will make a difference. If you're in bedrock, the energy goes quickly through the bedrock and you don't have as much shaking. If you are in soft soils, the energy gets trapped into that soft soil and it can't get out. So it just hangs on to it and it resonates, it bounces back and forth in that soft soil. We have over 4 miles of sediment underneath the Los Angeles Basin created by the movement of the San Andreas Fault. As it moves to the north, it breaks up all the rocks. So we have a lot of soft soil. Quality of construction of your building will make a difference. People will usually feel it on the second story, more so on the first story. And the depth of the hypocenter makes a difference. The further down in the ground that the earthquake starts, the more the energy is absorbed before it gets to the surface. You don't have as much shaking at the surface. If it is only a mile deep, you're going to have a lot more shaking at the surface of that. Could be the same earthquake that happened before. Case in point was the La Habra earthquake a year ago. 5.1 earthquake. 17 broken water pipes, damage to buildings, and a landslide. 2 years earlier, relatively same area, in Chino, magnitude 5.4 earthquake, no damage at all. The difference being is the one in La Habra was only a mile deep. And so there was a lot of surface shaking on the surface. So the depth of an earthquake will make a difference on what kind of shaking you're going to have. So this is the Los Angeles Basin. You can see here the amplification, and a lot of our Los Angeles Basin is in that heavy amplification because it has that soft soil. So, displacement. This is another thing that happens with earthquakes. So, you have the movement of rocks. So, if it thrusts one side of that wall, thrust forward, you're going to have an uplift. So, this is the Baja earthquake on your right. This is 7 feet of uplift, where the earth moved upward 7 feet. Nobody cared out in the middle of the desert, but put this in Hollywood, where they're debating right now whether to put that building on a fault or not. This is why. Because if that building is on that fault and you have 7 feet of uplift, what's going to happen to that building? Now, it may be built across the street. It's still going to have shaking, but it's not going to have that uplift. So this is the Hector Mine, that 7.1 earthquake, 10 feet of movement along that roadway. So you're going to have movement at the surface from those rocks moving. Now, although the Northridge was a blind thrust, so it did not break through the surface with that. San Francisco earthquake. This is a fence. It's not where they ran out of lumber or they didn't know how to build the fence. This is 30 feet of movement. San Francisco earthquake had 30 to 50 feet of movement along that fault zone. Buildings or houses are still standing, but if you went up and looked at them, they're probably not on their foundations. This is a barn. This is a manure pile on the left-hand side, a stain on the right-hand side. That barn moved that distance. So this is why you need to bolt your houses to the foundation, because that's what's going to create the heavy damage. You can replace the pool, you can replace the walls, you can replace the cement in the driveways, but it is the main structure of your house that you want to protect from that movement. This is Napa earthquake. 1,000 houses moved off their foundation. This is buckling of the streets that you can see up in Napa. Houses that were retrofitted did fine. Some buildings had done reconstruction as far as their heritage, and those did fine. Another dynamic of an earthquake is a tsunami. We are at jeopardy for offshore earthquakes in places like Alaska, Japan, Hawaii, Chile. Any earthquake around the Pacific Rim can travel across the Pacific Ocean and hit our coastline. And, of course, we saw that in Japan. 8 hours after that earthquake, those waves hit our coastline, creating $50 million in damages. So Crescent City, that has a lot of tsunamis, it has a trough in the water underneath the ocean. That tsunamis come right down that trough into Crescent City. San Francisco Bay was damaged, as well as Ventura, Santa Cruz, and Catalina Island. We're also at jeopardy for underwater landslides. So if we have a larger earthquake, probably not the San Andreas, because by the time the energy gets to the coast, it's lost some of its impact. But an earthquake on the Newport-Inglewood, the Rose Canyon, Puente Hills, the Ventura can create an underwater landslide. That then displaces the water. So what is a tsunami? Is the displacement of water. So where you have a fault zone where you have a thrust upward, that then thrusts upward and the water has to go somewhere. And that's what creates a tsunami. Again, we are a strike-slip fault. So therefore, we don't have that dynamic of tsunamis on the San Andreas. First of all, the San Andreas is on land. Part of it is out in the ocean at the top half. It's a strike-slip. So when it moves, it's not thrusting upward to then displacing that water. So in the movie of San Andreas, we're not looking at that 300-foot wall of water from that movie. Absolutely correct. You do not want to be surfing on a tsunami wave because it has the energy from that earthquake that is in that in those waves. And it's not always a wave. It could be a surge of water where the water level just rises and comes up. It's also not just one surge. It can go on for 3 days. Japan earthquake, they had tsunamis for 3 days on our coastline. It isn't just one time. So you do not want to be running down to the coastline. So you may say, okay, well, I live inland enough that I don't have to worry about a tsunami here in Los Angeles, but where do you go on vacation? Where do you go when it's hot? You go to the beach, right? Okay, you need to worry about those tsunamis. What do you see along our coastline? Tsunami signs, tsunami sirens. So that tsunami siren would go off. Now, when this earthquake happened, the NOAA report was sent out, and those tsunami sirens did go off, at least up north. Down here, it didn't affect us. You can go to the website at California Geological Survey. They have an inundation map that will then show you they have inundated what will happen with tsunamis along our coastline. And that was upgraded with the Japan earthquake. California Geological Survey is in charge of mapping California. That's where you'll find your fault maps. We might map them for them, but they are in charge of reporting. So that's where you will find fault maps. Is it USGS or Caltech, but you will find that California Geological Survey will have those maps. Also the inundation maps, you can click into any of those squares and see. So we're looking at Marina Del Rey being the lowest point and about a 6-block inundation with an offshore earthquake. That's right, and it's called forecasting. No, we do have an idea based on the dynamics of what can happen. They pardon? There is no patterns. No, there are no definite patterns, but there are certain laws of physics, and there are certain laws of geology. That is true. That's why we say never. We don't use the word never. We never say it cannot happen. But it may be. I think you may have missed the first part of the presentation where I actually talked about that. Well, but that's what I'm saying. We go by, we never say never, that it can't happen. It is science. The earth is always changing. We're always learning more. There were things that happened in Japan that the scientists over there didn't think could happen, and they did. However, there are some things that cannot because it is not within the function of that happening. And so now, we are a strike-slip fault. 16 billion years ago, we were a subduction zone. We had volcanoes. We could have had a 9.0 earthquake 16 million years ago. We are now, but that fault changed direction. And so we are now a strike slip. So in that dynamic, it can't create that. So we never say never, but the way it is now, because it could change. All right? And so that could change that way. But for where we are right now, we're not looking at that to happen. It is, but we can forecast. Forecasting is different than prediction. Forecasting is taking what we know from the past and being able to apply it to the future. It is a science, so we are constantly learning more, we're constantly updating things, and we're constantly pulling them back, too. And so it is a science. Mm-hmm. With a tsunami, okay, first of all, with a tsunami, there's two signs. First of all, if you feel shaking and you're by the water, the first thing you want to do is drop, cover, hold on, because it will take time for that water to group itself. You want to protect yourself first because you won't be able to run anyway. So protect yourself first, and then as soon as the shaking stops, go to higher ground. The other thing is if you are by the water and you see it receding. So you see it pulling back and you hear a noise from the ocean because it could be an offshore earthquake that you didn't know about. And so you see that water receding. Again, you want to go to higher ground. If it ended up not to be that, what have you lost but some exercise? No, it's going to pull back and it's going to recede, and that takes a while to be able to do that. It actually took 20 minutes for the tsunami waves to come into Japan. For them to pull back and do that, it's all physics. And so you have that displacement of the water. It actually, scientists think it was two tsunamis that came together creating that 30-foot wall of water. And so it took time for that uplift to happen, pull that water back, and to be able to do that, and it took about 20 minutes. So just save your questions for the end, but I do want to reiterate to you again, this is the knowledge that we know at this time of what can happen, what we think can happen, and of course mainly to let you know that. It's important people be educated about earthquakes because then they won't panic. So if you know what's happening, why the ground is moving, what's going to happen with that earthquake, then what we want to do is educate people so they don't panic. So they can think about how to prepare, how to be safe, and how to protect themselves during that earthquake. This is a website that you can go to that's a great resource. You can then put in your address. It will tell you what your risk is for fire, for flood, for liquefaction, and for tsunami. So if you're in the tsunami zone, if you're in the liquefaction zone. What's a liquefaction? Liquefaction is where you have a water table down below. You have soft soil on top of that. When you have shaking, the water percolates through the soft soil to the surface, and then you're sitting in water. This is what happened with Christchurch with the New Zealand earthquake. They probably won't be able to inhabit half of Christchurch because of the liquefaction. There are several liquefaction areas throughout Southern California, so to know if that's one of your risks, then you can put your address in here. It will tell you if you're at a risk for liquefaction, for tsunami, for fire, for flood, and if you're in an earthquake zone as well. Now, we know we're all in earthquake zone here in Southern California, but some are closer to faults than others. So we talked about not being able to predict earthquakes in an exact place and an exact time. We probably never will be able to do that because we don't know how much stress a fault's going to take before it's going to move or how far it's going to move. We also mentioned directionality, and there was one point that I think that we didn't make in that because I think there was a question. The Northridge earthquake was a good example of directionality of an earthquake and why it makes a difference. The Northridge earthquake ruptured from the south to the north. The heavy energy went into the Santa Susana Mountains and then over into not an unpopulated area, but not as populated area. If that earthquake had ruptured from the north to the south, same earthquake, same depth, same distance of rupture, but we would have had twice the damage because it would have pushed the heavy energy into Santa Monica. And you would have had twice the damage. You would have had a lot more damage than you had and a lot more shaking here had that ruptured the other direction. And so directionality of that rupture will make a difference. So you can take one earthquake and say, well, gee, with the same magnitude, why did they have so much damage on this one? Because of the directionality or the depth of that earthquake. So those will make a difference in what will happen with that earthquake. So how do we know what happened in the past? And this is why we do forecasting. So what we're talking about here is not a definite. It's what we know can happen and that has happened in the past, what can happen in the future, knowing the geology, the geodesy of earthquakes, the paleoseismology of earthquakes, putting that all in together and then to come up with our best estimate of what can happen in the future. And so we call it trenching. Where we know a fault exists, we can then dig down into that. So how do we know it existed there? We know where that movement was. We can see that. This is actually, well, I don't know which one this one is. At Caltech, we have a piece of the San Andreas Fault. So they would dig down as far as they can into that fault. With an earthquake, you have that movement. That movement of the earth is encapsulated as history under the sediment layers. So on top of that, we'll build your sediment. They can go down and they can date that sediment all the way down and find out what year it was. They can then look at those offsets. So you can see here where some of these offsets are. They know how much energy had to have been created to have the earth move that much. They can then estimate what the magnitude of that earthquake was, when it happened, how often you have these things happening. So we know in Southern California that we have a magnitude 7.5 or above about every 550 years. Now, it's been 300 years in the southern portion of the San Andreas Fault. Our last larger earthquake in Southern California was in 1857 with a magnitude 7.9. And 1906, they had a magnitude 7.8 earthquake. It actually traveled further than the Fort earthquake, but the Fort Tejon had more friction in it. So it created more energy, even though the other one traveled further. So we know that we have these larger earthquakes in Southern California. We don't know if it's going to be today or tomorrow or in 10 years or in 15 years or in 20 years or in 30 years. We know we have them. We know we will have them again. Because as that plate moves to the north, it's going to pull. And that pull will create stress on those faults. So it has been 300 years with the southern portion of the San Andreas Fault. So we are way overdue for another large earthquake. It may be in your lifetimes. It may be in the lifetimes of your children. Or it may be a 6.7 in your neighborhood. So it may not be that 7.8 that affects all the counties of Los Angeles, of Southern California. It may be a large earthquake in your neighborhood that is just as devastating. So when we do a forecasting, not a prediction, but a forecasting, we do it for a 30-year period. And people say, yeah, I've been hearing that for 50 years. They keep saying 30 years. Why is it now 0 years? Because when they forecast, it is then used for insurance purposes so they can establish the risk level. It is used for planning purposes. What they do is they use a formula. Every formula has a constant. The constant is 30 years. Why do they use 30 years? Because that's the mortgage rate. And we used to pay off our houses in 30 years. Many of you here have done that. That is the constant. So the 30 years does not change. What does change is the percentage. So we are now at 93% probability that we will have a 6.7 again in 30 years. That could be today, tomorrow, next year, or after, but we will have one. A 7.5, we are at 36% probability of having that in the next 30 years. And so these are used for planning purposes to know what can happen and what to plan for. So we don't have a Katrina where people sat there and said, if we had only known those levees could break, we could have prepared ahead of time. So we looked at what is our biggest risk here in California. Our biggest risk here is, of course, fires. But what does the damage? Earthquakes. Earthquakes do the biggest damage because they cover the biggest area and they affect the biggest population. And they affect all of our economy. So it is the biggest risk that we have here. So we then created a scenario of what will happen when we have another 7.8 earthquake. And I will show you that here. So we took with our computers at Caltech, we're able to simulate earthquakes. We're able to take the energy from the Fort Tejon 1857 earthquake, simulate that, put that earthquake on the southern portion of the San Andreas, going from the south to the north, pushing the heavy energy out of a populated area, so not the worst scenario. We then ran that to see what's going to happen to Southern California. So when we ran that shake map, we could then see what's going to happen. We then shared that information with all of our emergency responders to see what's going to happen when we have that 7.8 earthquake. And why do that? Okay, so earthquake has started. It could stop right now, and it'd just be a magnitude 3, a 4, a 5, but it continues to rupture the fault. As it ruptures, it's like unzipping a zipper, letting out that energy, creating more and more energy, which is a larger magnitude, the measurement of that energy. We're now at a minute, has not reached Los Angeles yet, but it's still shaking in Palm Springs. Why? Because of the soft soil. It's still rupturing as the waves are coming into Los Angeles. It now stops rupturing. It's not creating any more energy, but the energy it did create is being trapped into that soft soil along our Los Angeles basin, where we have over 4 miles of sediment underneath the Los Angeles basement because of the movement of the San Andreas Fault. And so from this scenario, we could see that we're looking at up to 2 minutes of shaking in many areas of the Los Angeles basement, and Northridge shook for 14 seconds. And so with that 2 minutes of shaking, that's going to do a lot of damage. So using technology to be able to see what could happen, it's not to say it will, it's to say that this could happen. So again, the earthquake starts on the left. These colors that you're seeing is our modified Mercalli scale, not magnitude. It is the measurement of the intensity of shaking. So as it ruptures, that front is going to be your P wave. So you see the blue. You're going to see it coming into the Los Angeles basin from the San Andreas Fault as it travels. So here comes the P wave into Pasadena. Followed by that, you see the heavy red. That is going to be your surface wave. So it's turning red, has more shaking in it, because that is your surface wave. So there came your P wave, so you're going to drop cover and hold on, because now you're feeling shaking. Again, that won't have your damaging shaking, but it will have shaking. And then it will be followed by that S wave. And you will see the colors change. As it travels, you will see the intensity get stronger. You'll also see it split over here as it goes through the mountain range. So Pasadena is pretty much toast, but you drop cover, hold on, so you've protected yourself. And here you see how you have lighter shaking in the middle, because that's a mountain range. So as the energy went through that mountain range, you don't have as much shaking because those waves went faster. Also Palos Verdes, you see, does not have as much shaking because they're not going anywhere because they're surrounded by everybody that did shake hard. So we can use this technology, use the information of what we know now, of what we think could happen, and to be able to then create a plan. So FEMA sat down and created a catastrophic plan of how they will address this, having an earthquake of this size. We also sat down with all of our lifelines, our water, our power, our transportation, our communication, our sociologists, our health departments, to be able to find out our engineers as to how is this going to translate for you and me. So we know with this size earthquake, it is going to affect 8 counties of Southern California. The least affected by this scenario is San Diego. But it will affect 8 counties of Southern California. It will not be a Northridge event where you can go out of the area, you can go get food, go get water, go stay with relatives. This will affect 8 counties of Southern California. So looking at this, 300,000 buildings will be significantly damaged. That's 1 out of 16. Widespread infrastructure damage to all of our lifelines, our pipelines, our electricity, our transportation, our roads. $213 billion in damages, 270,000 people being displaced for long periods of time, 50,000 injuries that need hospitalization, 1,800 deaths. Our hospitals look to be okay with this because they have done a lot of retrofitting. Many of them will have departments that they have to close down because of broken pipes, because of damage inside, but they will be operational. Also, Caltrans has spent $16 billion retrofitting bridges and overpasses. Those look to be okay, but hundreds of thousands of buildings and overpasses owned by cities and counties that will not fare well. When you go home tonight, count how many bridges and overpasses you go under. How many roads you go? Do you know how to get there if you have to go a different route? Are you going to know how to get home from this? So we sat down with all of our experts to then see what's going to happen, to be able to share this with our emergency response teams, our government, and our communities, to know what they need to be prepared for. We know that our roads will be out. Highway 15 and Highway 10 will be affected from this. So Highway 5 will be the only way in and out of Los Angeles Basin. I'm going to have to stay here and do this, I think. Okay, so I'll squat down. Okay, so Highway 5 will be the only way in and out of Southern California. Our water supply will be significantly damaged. So we're looking at all our pipes are over 100 years old. We know that they break now just on regular use, but they will all be broken for this. The water, they don't even make up enough pipes worldwide to be able to replace them quick enough. We're looking at 18 months for full restoration to where we are today. That doesn't mean you won't get water to your household sooner, but for full restoration for everything, 18 months. So the main thing you need to have is water. You can live without food. You cannot live without water. It's 1 gallon per person per day for at least 7 to 10 days, if not 3 to 4 weeks or longer. 72 hours is not enough. There are no evacuation sites that have been set up in any recent disasters that have been set up in 3 days. Why? Because people are going to take care of their own families first before they go and set up those evacuation sites. You have to be able to take care of yourselves. We're looking at utilities being down. Again, some places will have utilities within 1 to 4 months, but 18 months for full restoration to where it is today. Phones will be totally overwhelmed. Cell service will not be available. Cell towers are not protected by earthquakes. They also are on buildings that will be damaged. So cell phones will be down. Also, the transmission is changed by the cloud of dust that goes up into the air. And so we've seen this with small earthquakes. La Habra earthquake. I'm not going to take questions right now because I need to get through this. Okay? Otherwise, we'll be here all night. Just hang on to them. So you need to have a means of communication. It is key. After a disaster, one of the first things people want to do is communicate with other people. So ham radio is the way to communicate. So have ham radio. That's the only means of communication that has worked in any disaster worldwide. So you need to have ham radio. Have a way of communication. Have a communication plan within your family. So you designate somebody out of the area. You might be able to text. That uses a different broadband, so you might be able to text. If you can get one message off, you want to send it to one person. That's your contact for everybody in your family. So everybody in your family contacts Aunt Mary in Arizona, says, I'm fine, I'm okay, and everybody works through one person so you get that information. Gas outages will be widespread. Gas pipes will be broken. That creates our fires as well. And so you will have light-ups in certain areas. They say 2 to 4 weeks with 60% restored in pockets with light-ups, so those will be designated areas for service to be able to do those. Gas valves. If you smell gas, turn it off. If you don't smell gas, do not turn it off. It could be weeks or months before they come and turn it back on for you. So with gas, it is smell, it is sight, and it is sound. So sight would be if you don't know, trust your smeller and you don't trust anything else, look at your dials. When you go home or tomorrow in the light, look at your dials, what's normal for you. If they're spinning out of control, then you're losing gas. So you want to go by sight, by smell, and by hearing, whether you hear it. So you need to then know how to turn it off, keep that gas valve by it. We're looking at 1,600 ignitions of fires with this event. That is going to be from broken gas mains, arcing wires, wires that will fall and then create fires that will happen with the main shock as well as aftershocks. So you need to have a fire extinguisher, know how to use it. Throwing it at the fire will not put that fire out. So you need to know how to use that fire extinguisher. Have a three-way. So you want to have one that will be used for chemicals, for electrical, and for wood, putting out fires. You also want to have one in the house as well as putting one on the front step. Why do you put one on the front step? Because as arcing wires fall, somebody walking out there checking the houses, checking your neighborhood after that disaster, they can put that fire out immediately. So we don't want you to put out a conflagration, but what you can do is put out a fire before it becomes that conflagration. And so have a fire extinguisher, know how to use it. Building damages, we have a lot of non-retrofitted buildings in Los Angeles still. And, of course, Lucy's been working on that with the mayor for the last year to try to get people to actually do something about those buildings that need to be retrofitted. Many of them were Northridge events where we had soft story damage, we had steel frame damage. We know what can happen. They need to retrofit those buildings. So we're looking at over 50 collapses of buildings. Even if this earthquake is 100 miles away, they are affected by long-range waves. So it doesn't have to be the waves that are coming across the surface. Waves also go up into the air. And so they will hit long range. So Paso Robles earthquake that happened a few years ago, if you were in a building in Los Angeles, you felt it on the 11th floor. Because long range waves will hit tall buildings and they will do damage. Transportation will be affected. So our roads will be broken. Bridges and overpasses will be down. Also landslides. So debris will be on those roadways. They may be impassable. This will make a difference in our manpower. So where do most of our emergency service people live? Do they live in the city that they work? No. They live in Lancaster, Palmdale, Rancho Cucamonga, Santa Bernardino, Riverside. They're going to take care of their families first. Then they're going to try to get to where you are, where they work. And if that's Los Angeles and Highway 15 is down and Highway 10 is down, it's going to take them a long time to get here. So everybody has to be self-sufficient. Know also you need to have supplies in your car. Because if you have to abandon your car and walk for 5 miles, 10 miles, 15 miles, then you need to have supplies. How many people right now can walk for 10 or 15 miles in the shoes they have on? Okay, good for you. Shoes need to be strong shoes because you're going to be walking through debris. You're going to be walking through glass. So think about walking through that debris, and it can go through the soles of your shoes. So make sure in your car you have heavy shoes, you have water, you have a flashlight or a headlamp. Headlamp will leave your hands free. It will also enable you, they also last longer. LED lights will last for about 2 years, where those flashlights are always going dead. So also have a hard hat, have gloves, because you will be touching debris and moving it. So you want to have gloves. So if you don't have anything else, you'd want to have that. You always have supplies where you work, where you play, and in your car. And so you want to have those supplies in those places. Know that if you are at work, you may not be able to get home. And so you might have to shelter in place. So you might want to have a little bag of emergency items, any medications you need to have, any eyeglasses if you have to have them. When you get new pairs, put your old ones in your emergency kits. Make sure that you have granola bars. You might also want to put your makeup, because that's important too, as you're emotional. You want to have some toiletries, and you keep those in a drawer at work so that you always have those supplies with you. Knowing that this will be a regional catastrophe that will affect 8 counties, but together, if we all work together and are prepared, then that disaster does not become a catastrophe. You then are the solution instead of part of the problem. If you're prepared, you don't become part of that problem, you become part of the solution. If you become part of the solution, the recovery to the area is a lot faster. And that's what this is all about, is survival and recovery. We cannot stop the earthquake from happening. But what we can do is be prepared for it. And if we're prepared for it, then we don't have as much as a catastrophe for that. So it's not if, it is when we will have another major earthquake. What you do now before that earthquake will make a difference in your lives afterwards. You need to know that everybody has to be self-sufficient. We cannot rely on emergency responders. We have to take care of ourselves and work together. So first of all, you want to prepare ahead of time, secure your space. Anything that can fall down will fall down. Anything that's heavy that you put to the bottom of the cabinet instead of at the top. So when it falls to the ground and it doesn't fall on you. Anything that can be secured should be secured. Doesn't mean it's still not going to fall down. You have heavy shaking at your location. Those bolts are probably going to come out of the wall. But it may buy you time that you get past that grandfather clock before it falls and you get into your safe place. Before it falls on you. So anything, this is the La Habra earthquake. This is a magnitude 5.1. Unsecured items from the La Habra earthquake. So you can imagine with a larger earthquake what is going to happen. Water heaters, make sure they're secured. You have 35 gallons of water in that water heater that's usable water. You got to know how to get it out, however. Know how to turn the spigot, turn off your gas, not at the main line if it's not leaking, but at your water heater. Turn that off first. Then you need to know how to turn it, and you have to siphon off the rust because there's dirt and rust in the bottom of that, so you need to do that. Refrigerators in Northridge earthquake were known to go out the walls. They went all the way across the house, out the wall, into the street. So anything that's not secured, you've got that energy behind that refrigerator, that energy is traveling in your direction, goes through your house, it's going to push that refrigerator right out the door. So you need to have everything secured. So don't say it's too heavy, it's not going to move. It can move anything that's in its way. Look at the people that talk about the Northridge earthquake and what happened to them. So it's not just us saying that. This comes from people that experienced it. So you want to have an evacuation. So after the earthquake, you want to have an evacuation or meeting place. So in your neighborhood, you work as neighborhoods, as the neighbors. You contact your neighborhood. It's called Map Your Neighborhood. In the city of Los Angeles, it's called the 5-step program to mapping your neighborhood. Teaches you how to work as neighbors. Have an evacuation site afterwards. You want an open space with no electrical wires, nothing that's going to fall on you with those aftershocks. Out-of-state contact. Make sure you know where your emergency supplies are. Have copies of all your important documents. Anything you need to start over. If everything is damaged, then you need to have those documents. Your insurance papers, your credit card numbers. Because you're going to call those credit card people and say, hey, I'm in a disaster area, so I'm not paying my bill for a few months, so don't charge me a fee. And so you want to be able to call those people when you can. You want to have, and people forget normal phone numbers. You may think you know all your relatives' phone numbers, but in a disaster, you'll forget your own phone number. So don't keep them in your phone because your phone will go dead. So if you can't use the phone, you've lost all those phone numbers. Write them down. I keep them on the inside of my cover of my phone, so I still have them written down. Phone lines, do not get rid of your landline. You will get service first to a landline. Make sure, satellite phone is line of sight. They're expensive, however, and you have to have line of sight. Ham radio is the best thing to have. You can also send NTS, is National Traffic System. If you find somebody that's a ham radio operator, they can contact a ham radio operator in the area of your emergency contact. They will then call that person or send them a note telling them that you're okay, whatever message that you're transferring back and forth. And so internet, we hope, is still up. It was up in the Japan earthquake. We don't know because we've not had a magnitude 6 or a 7 or an 8 in Los Angeles since we've had internet. So we don't know how that's going to work. We can only hope that it's still working. We have with our system of network of getting the data, we have a redundant system. So have numbers of your doctors, of your family, of your insurance companies, and keep those. If you trust your emergency contact, give that information to them so you can always access this information afterwards. Again, work as neighborhoods. Also, CERT training. It is community emergency response training that teaches you 4 modules of fire suppression, how to put out a fire, how to do basic first aid, how to set up a communication system, how to do search and rescue, how to lift a heavy object off of somebody, and you will see that in the San Andreas movie, where they lifted a heavy cement block off of somebody using that leverage, and that they teach you that in CERT to be able to do that. So have your emergency kits. This is your main kit at home. You're going to have everything that you use on a daily basis. Again, your medications. You're also going to have a rope. It can be used to tie things up. Duct tape can be used for anything. You also want to have trash bags, not just to put trash in, but also you can use them for a raincoat. You can use them for debris. You can use them for shelter. You can use those bags for a lot of different things. You want to also have a mask because in an earthquake, it digs up the debris underneath the ground. Under the ground is bacteria. In an earthquake, then when you have shaking, that then propagates to the surface, goes up in the air. With the Northridge earthquake, it was called Valley Fever. That then settled in our San Gabriel Mountains. When they had the fire, it was dredged up again. It's still there. It's still living. That bacteria doesn't die. And so you want to have a mask that you're not breathing the dust. You also want to have goggles so that you can be able to see. Always keep your gas tank half full. Why? Because you can charge your phone. You can listen to the radio. So you always want to have that gas tank half full. You're not going to get out of town, and we don't want you on the roads. That's going to be for emergency services. Always have cash. ATMs will not be working. So you need to have cash so you're not paying $20 for something that costs $2 and $3, and you can make change. You also want to have an extra set of keys. With that. So, this is La Habra earthquake. He remembered after that earthquake that we told him to store water, and he hadn't stored that water. So what's he doing? He's out there getting water out of the broken water main. What is normally next to a water pipe? A sewer pipe. And with this case, same, the sewer pipe was broken. So he was getting contaminated water. So you want to save that water ahead of time. So you want to save it in bottles. You can save those for 6-7 months. It varies. It depends on the plastic. The plastic will disintegrate in time, so you don't want to have a flood. You can save it in 35-gallon, 55-gallon drums. Those last for 5 years. You fill them out of the water hose, and then in 5 years, you water your plants, you refill it again. It comes with a purification system. The ones on the right are good for the car because they can go from hot to cold and not become contaminated. Know your building. Yeah, the plastic bottles, they'll crack and the water will seep out.
Oh, and the water will seep out.
Yeah. If you store them on a cement floor, it will disintegrate faster. There's a chemical reaction between the plastic and the cement, and they'll disintegrate faster, so you want to have a buffer between that. Always know the buildings that you're in so you know where to go and where your safe places are going to be. And to know after that shaking, do you stay in the building or do you go outside? And so you need to know that building. Was it retrofitted? What are the hazards in that building? Know how to drop, cover, and hold on. This is the earthquake in Baja. This is our Imperial Valley. The deaths are just fine, but look at the non-structural. So we want to protect you from that non-structural damage. So what do you do in an earthquake? Do not ever run. Do not run outside. If you go outside, you may not know this building. You might think, oh, this looks like an old building, but maybe it's been retrofitted and it's just fine. You go outside that building, everything's going to be coming off that building. The tiles on the roof, the roofing, the chimney might be coming off, and that will travel for a distance. So you don't want to be running outside the building because you'll hit by falling debris. If you're in bed, you stay in bed. Do not get next to the bed. Northridge earthquake, beds went up in the air, came down on people. So you don't want to be getting next to the bed. You want to stay in bed, pull the covers up over your head, put a pillow over your head, wait for the shaking to stop. Hopefully you've secured your items. The one death in the Napa earthquake was somebody getting hit in the head by their television. Okay? They fell asleep in the recliner, TV hit them in the head, killed them. You want to make sure you secure those items even in your bedroom. So if you're in bed, you stay in bed. Now, what's the first thing you're going to do after the shaking stops? You're going to jump out of bed and step on glass. Exactly. Biggest injury in the Northridge earthquake was cut feet. So, shoes under the bed, tied to the underside of the bed, because in the shaking, the shoes will end up somewhere else. So tie them to the underside. I put them in one of those canvas bags with the handles, and I tie the handles to the foot of the bed, because it goes up and down. It's going to come loose, but to the frame of the bed. And so in that, I have a hard hat, I have my gloves, I have my LED light with my headlamp, I have extra clothes, because in the Northridge earthquake, people started leaving those apartment houses, and some people didn't have any clothes on. They forgot that they go to bed naked. So you might want to have clothes in there, because you may not be able to get back into the house and change out of those pajamas. So you might want to have clothes, but you want to have those shoes, and you want to have a flashlight so you're not tripping over objects with that. That's hard to do, and if you get cramps at night in those feet, that's even harder. Don't go next to the bed. Bed goes up in the air, comes down on you. Do not get next to anything unless you can help it. If you hear about triangle of life, do not do triangle of life. It tells you to get next to something instead of under it. You're much better off under it. They tell you if the roof falls down, it falls on here, and you're in this void space. What's the chances it's going to fall on this and not fall on you? So you want to be under something. Businesses need to have a plan to keep their doors open. It is huge to the recovery of the area that all businesses stay operational. So have a backup plan. Make sure all employees practice. Have a plan at home so they can come to work. If you come to work, you get a paycheck. You get a paycheck, you don't have to move out of the area. So it's imperative that all our businesses have a backup plan. Shakeout drill is on October the 15th. It's an opportunity for everybody to drill their plan. Practice drop, cover, hold on. Think about what you're going to do. Do you have your supplies? Do you know where your safe places are? Do you have water? Do you have a fire extinguisher? Have you secured your items? And then this is an opportunity to go through and check those things and do those things if you haven't done them. This is our website, shakeout.org. It will tell you what to do in the event of an earthquake. Actually, go to earthquakecountry.org. That's where we have all our preparedness information. No. Well, I take that back. After the shaking, then you've already evaluated your safe place. So if you go outside, you want to make sure you're in a place that you're not going to have falling wires from aftershocks, so that things aren't going to fall on you outside. So part of your preparedness is that you already know your safe place outside, and are you going to go outside? Sometimes you're better off staying where you are, depending on how much shaking and how much damage to that structure. You should not drive until you know what's happening, because you might drive somewhere and get stuck. So first you want to evaluate, and that's what we do in Map Your Neighborhood. So after the earthquake, what do? You first of all check for injuries in your household. You're then going to check for gas leaks. Smell gas, turn it off. Don't smell gas, don't turn it off. Then you're going to turn off your water to the house. Not at the street, but the water to your house. Why? Because it will trap the good water in your pipes. And you won't get contaminated water from the street that's coming into your house. So you want to shut off the water to your house and preserve that water. Then what you do is then you stand on the front porch and you say, now what do I do? Okay? Nobody's going to come to help you. They're going to be doing other things. And that's why you work in your neighborhood. Because then you pick in your neighborhood a safe spot. Everybody goes to that safe spot. It might be somebody's front yard. It might be a lean-to that's safe. Because you have to check out to make sure it's safe first, and then you work together. Then from there, teams go out and check the residents for leaking gas, injuries, and they check the residents and come back and report, and you all work together. Okay? All right, so resources are, well, how do we monitor earthquakes? Any other questions on preparedness? Stay off the hand phone and put your phone back on the cradle. If it's off the cradle, it is busy. And it can't, it ties up the lines. If you are, if you have a landline and don't get rid of those landlines, and if you have AT&T UVerse, you may not have a landline anymore. Because they disconnect your landline if they hook up the voicemail and they don't tell you that. So you may not have it anymore if you have that. But keep those landlines and they will not reconnect you once they've disconnected it. Then, well, good question, ham radio. Because cell phones probably won't be operational if it's a large event. If it has affected your area, then you will, probably will not be able to use your cell phone. Also, it will affect electricity is out, and all your other phones, your wireless phones, are connected to electricity. And it's going to go dead, so you're not going to have those. So what you want to do is know that ahead of time and have that backup plan. So if you don't have those, then ham radio. What's the most important thing to do? The most important thing to do is, first of all, be able to protect yourself and your family and secure your house. Those are the three things you want to do. So you, first of all, want to know your safe places so you can protect yourself when the earth shakes. Then you want to have your preparedness items so you can survive that earthquake. Then you want to retrofit your house to make sure you don't have that loss to your house. No, you don't. Yeah, I have them in three places. I have my important documents Xeroxed, and I have them in my car, in my backpack in the car. I have it in my backpack at work, and I have it in my emergency supplies at home. I also have it with my emergency contact, who is my brother that lives in Colorado. So I can always get the information from him. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, in a disaster, you take that backpack with you. Absolutely. Even if it's just outside. So the next thing I wanted to show you was our what we do at Caltech. We monitor earthquakes at Caltech. And how do we do that? We have run the Southern California Seismic Network, which is a network of 400 stations that were buried throughout Southern California. So when an earthquake happens, our instruments pick up the ground motion, sends it back to Caltech at the speed of light. How fast do the waves travel? 2 miles per second. At distance of time, we can send out a warning. Okay, we get the information, we can process that information before those waves hit our location if the earthquake starts far enough away. So, with this information, what do we do with this? This is what our sensors look like. They're buried in the ground. They're not very deep. They're only about 5 to 10 feet deep. But they will record information, ground motion information, miles deep in the ground. And there again, and if an earthquake starts, it starts very deep in the ground, we have more warning time because by the time it hits the surface, we've had those extra milliseconds to be able to record that. So these are stations that are buried in the ground. We've been doing this since the 1920s. We now have 400 stations. They are all digital. We have no more analog, which were slower. These are much faster. We have a redundant system of getting the information back to Caltech. So we use phone lines, we use internet, we use microwave, we use satellite. So if one system is down, then we use the others. Also, some of our stations are in very remote areas. We can't tie into internet or phone lines, so we have to rely on microwave or satellite for those to be able to do that. Why do we do this? We do this to understand earthquakes. So we collect that data, we archive the data, so we can go back 80 years, tell you what earthquakes have occurred in an area. People use this information worldwide, especially all of our lifelines, to be able to build their infrastructure to find out how deep they need to be put pipes, where they can put pipes, and they use this information all the time. We also have created earthquake tools. So to be able to reduce losses during an earthquake for our emergency responders to know where to respond. So first of all, we have earthquake early warning, which is a co-seismic tool. It is not a prediction. Earthquake has started. We are then sending an alert that those waves are coming. The further away you are, the more warning time you get. The next one is our CISN display that records earthquakes in near real time worldwide. So earthquakes that have occurred, it pops up on here within seconds, and then it is verified. It comes off our system and then is verified by a person to make sure the information is correct. It gives you the depth, the location, the magnitude for our emergency responders. ShakeMap is another tool that can be used by the public. You can access this. A 3.5 earthquake or above, it will tell you the probability of the intensity of shaking. It takes the ground motion, combines it with the geology of the area, so where the bedrock is, where the soft soils are, It then estimates the ground shaking in that area. So you can go to these maps after an earthquake and see where did it shake the hardest and how did it shake where you are. And then you can go ahead and see what happened with that earthquake. With our emergency responders, they know where to respond. Northridge earthquake, they didn't know for over 36 hours that there was a lot of damage in Santa Clarita. So they did not send help there. They were concentrating on Highway 14 and where the bridge fell down, Northridge, Santa Monica, but they were not concentrated in Santa Clarita. They now know within 2 minutes that they had damage in Santa Clarita and they would in Simi Valley, and they would respond there. This is also worldwide. They're better here in the United States because of all our seismic sensors. The more sensors you have, the more dense and faster they can do it. An earthquake notification, you can sign up for that at our website, and we will send you the information on that earthquake. So what is earthquake early warning? It's the ability to provide a few seconds of warning before those damaging waves hit your location. What is it for? Public alerts to get people into a safe place. Also triggered automated responses, such as opening up elevator doors so that the elevator goes to a floor, stops, lets people out so they're not trapped inside. Open up fire station doors so our fire trucks are not stuck inside. It can then slow down trains so that they don't derail. If they're going fast, the waves travel over the tracks and it pushes the train over. So slow down trains. Also controls signals. All the signals go red. Cars aren't moving in the intersections. Vincent Thomas Bridge would stop people from over the bridge, would send an alert. So it can also shut down caustic material so it doesn't create fires afterwards. So there's lots of things that can be triggered with earthquake early warning to eliminate damage afterwards. There are limitations. If you are close to the epicenter, you don't have enough time for an early warning. That is called the zero zone. However, the earthquake we had 2 weeks ago in Baldwin Hills, it was a 4.1 earthquake. We were able to give an early warning to that locality because it was about 17 miles deep. And so because of the depth, our instruments picked it up, sent the alert, and we sent the alert out, and even the people that were close to got that alert. So we're learning more and more what it can do. Well, you can't yet. It's not public ready yet. Okay? So people need to know, be educated, first of all. There could be false alerts. We have more than one earthquake happening at a time, and so there could be the possibility of false alert, or the warning could be too late, so people have to be educated to that. So how is the information going to get to you? Caltech and UC Berkeley have built this and developed it. USGS will run it because they're in the business of running things for long periods of time. Plus, this will now... California runs a seismic network for California. We have developed it for California. University of Washington has now adopted Shake Alert. They will be running it for Oregon and Washington. So it is now going to be the Pacific Northwest Early Warning System. How do you get the alert? It will come across on cell phones. It will be an app that you will get it from there. It will be radio. It will be television. The challenge is latency. We only have seconds. And so some of these ways of getting the alert to you take too much time. And if it takes too much time, it's no good. We do not have a fast network emergency response system in the United States. We have only built things as we need them. They are not the fastest. And so there is a latency which slows down the early warning. And that's a challenge for us of doing early warning in California. But still, we can do it, so we need to have it. So knowing what those limitations are, education of the public will be key. Learning when you get that alert and it tells you how many seconds you have and what is the intensity of shaking, that you know how to then analyze that and how to respond. And that's going to be key. So education will be key. We also have to deal with multiple languages, multiple cultures, people with special needs, so deaf, blind, people with medical challenges, people that have mental challenges. Being able to do that, because people that have certain dyslexias or whatever aren't going to respond to that. And so dealing with this, and it's a challenge. Other countries, Japan has early warning, Mexico has early warning. They built it, they put it out there, they don't worry about these things. They just put it out. We can't do that in the United States. It has to be robust, it has to work well, it has to cover all people's needs. So education will be key. So Knowing that, first of all, in an earthquake, you're going to drop cover, hold on. You're going to secure your space. You're going to have water. You're going to have a fire extinguisher. You're going to drill your plant, and you're going to know what to do in that event of that earthquake. I will play you an example of early warning so that you can see what that looks like. And there again, this is a, how do I get to my toolbar? Yikes. Oh, it's over here. It moved. This was a demonstration product, so don't pay attention to the noise. It's not going to be this noise. We're actually researching right now what the noise should sound like to alert people but not scare them. But this is our demonstration product. To be able to demonstrate it, we didn't worry about it with this. And these are the people that are beta testing it. We've been beta testing it for over 2 years with many of our cities, counties, schools, lifelines have been beta testing it for us. Oh.
Earthquake.
So.
Shaking.
Earthquake has started. It's actually tracking the earthquake. It doesn't just pick it up at the point source and say this is what it is. It's tracking that earthquake because it could stop right now and we'd have moderate shaking in Pasadena. But it continues to rupture. And as it continues to rupture, then our intensities are going to change. So the algorithms we have built in have then, we have three algorithms that look at that energy. It then determines and estimates the magnitude of that earthquake based on the energy that is being released, the intensity of shaking at your location, and how many seconds before the S wave, the damaging waves, arrives at your location. And then it will count down so you see it changing from moderate to strong because the rupture is still rupturing, and so we have heavier energy at Pasadena. So in your cell phones, it will track you by GPS. If it's stationary, you will put your latitude, longitude in so it knows where you are. If it comes across on the television, we obviously don't know where you are. So it will come across and most likely just say earthquake, earthquake. Then you will drop cover, hold on. If you felt no shaking, then it wasn't near you. But if it was, then you are prepared for that. Radio, same thing. We don't know where you are. So it will be earthquake, earthquake. And so it will come across. We're checking with all of our experts, with actually University of Kentucky. A team is looking into what the message should be, what the sound should be able to get that information out to the public. So we're looking at 3 years to the public ready, depending on what funding we get for this. More people we can hire to do these things, the faster we can get it out there with the funding we have right now, which is nothing, or we're looking at about 3 years. So that's it. Any questions?
Thank you.